Blake thought that we have four states of mind, four states of imaginative mind. And when you get these four different qualities of experience sort of broadly, you know, into you in some way, then you can watch what state of mind you're in any particular moment. He called them Ulro, Generation, Beulah, and Eternity. Now, the names in Blake are often immediately off-putting. The upside is it makes you do a bit of work in order to sort of take them on board. And that's worth doing because then you get a feel for it yourself and then can do this discernment of both what state you're in and what state you find yourself in, maybe in a particular group at a particular time in a particular society. And that buys you the freedom to be able to navigate to a new state of mind, a new quality of imagination. So let me see if I can sort of bring them alive for you right now. First of all, Ulro. Actually, if you've seen any image of Blake's, you'll have seen one of Blake's most famous images of the Ulro state of mind. And it's his figure of your reason. It's the Ancient of Days, the bearded old man who leans out the sky, compasses in hand, shaping the world. And that, in a way, sums up it all, even in the name. This is the state of mind that trusts reason. It trusts generalizations. It likes to abstract from reality in rules and laws because then it feels it has control and possession of reality. But the compasses which your reason has to measure and to assess and to generalize also limit. Because any kind of generalization, any kind of abstraction takes you away from reality. Now, we all do that. I'm doing that in this talk right now. But the mistake that Ulro makes is that it confuses its abstraction and generalization with reality. It forgets it's serving something else. It adopts his camera mentality rather than the mentality of the Aeolian harp. And so it contracts reality. It's actually, Blake thought, death-loving secretly, because it wants to pull back from life in order to hold on to how it understands life. So, examples in the world around us. I think that economics often falls into this state of mind. You know, the thing that's very strange about economic reality, the economy that we serve, is that it measures the world, taking the measurements that precisely make the world that it's measuring, you know, and then it collapses it down onto one measurement, often GDP, as if GDP is somehow a whole world into which we're supposedly growing. But of course, it feels thin, it feels too small the minute you start to think about it, it feels too clunky and clumsy. I'm speaking during the right in the middle of the coronavirus. And sometimes when I listen to the statisticians trying to assess where we're at now, I feel there's a kind of Eurism, Ulro mentality going on. Because what happens is that different statisticians come up with different models of where we're at in the crisis. And then they compete. Because to make their statistical model, to make their inferences, they're having to collapse and pull back from reality. And I do wonder, you know, a bit like economics, whether they actually do us more harm than serve us, because they almost inevitably entice us to confuse the model with reality. And then when the model fails, we get disillusioned, or we get angry, we get cross. So you can feel the Ulro mentality, Eurism, the God, the deity, the power, the principality is very powerful in the world, particular times of middle of 2020, but generally the modern world too. So it has this upside of control, power, technology, security. You know, it's not to be sniffed at. Security is often most noticed when you don't have it. So we shouldn't be too sniffy about Ulro and what he hopes to bring. But nonetheless, it collapses onto what Blake famously called single vision and Newton's sleep. And the sleep there is it doesn't know there's a wider reality. So the downside is it gets caught up in utilitarian calculation as if that can deliver all. It treats life as abstract, which means that life becomes competitive You know, much like numbers have to add together or subtract from each other or divide each other, reality itself is in this kind of competitive calculation. It doesn't really know what love is. It thinks that love is just possessing. And it doesn't really know what imagination is. It feels that we're fated, that we can't be creative at all. You know, it's like Schopenhauer's impersonal will. It's just this kind of drive through life that pushes things on and can't be negotiated with, let alone loved, let alone regarded as part of a creative process. It must be measured, possessed and controlled. And when people talk about imagination in the sense of something creative, something that is expansive, something that might see the world in a different way, it treats that as sheer fancy. It says it's just your delusions. In fact, it treats consciousness itself as a delusion in its most reductive moments. Now, the good thing about Allro, Blake said, is that when things become really focused, when a system becomes really feeling like it's captured something and got it all, what it's actually doing is showing up the errors of the system. And immediately you can feel the errors of Allro. And even the most reductive materialist scientists can't live in the Allro world because, as sometimes remarked, at the end of the day, they still go home and kiss their children and tuck them up in bed at night. And they don't actually just live by abstraction from reality. And this leads to Blake's second state of mind, which he called generation. Now, if reason rules in Allro, it's reproduction that rules in generation. It's in the word, he sometimes calls it the vegetative state too, because he thought that it's in a way how plant life tends to live. He was thinking particularly of the plant life which, you know, when humans leave ruins, quickly takes over the ruins. It has a kind of relentless drive to it. When it is manifest in the human world, it gives rise to his famous dark satanic mills that just, as it were, spread over the landscape, suck up the life around it, even the plant life around it, to produce. I think viruses, you might say, are this half-life that exists in this generation domain as well. That is the soul that shapes them. The virus that will invade the body, multiply until it's either killed or kills the body. It's that state of life which he's talking about in generation. In the marketing world of today, the consumer world of today, I think it's kind of brand extension in a way. You know, it's the toothpaste that constantly resells itself, but actually it's still just toothpaste. Slightly more lighter example, but that is generation two. Now, it has twofold vision for Blake, because it sees itself and the need to survive, the environment it must take control of, the brands that must be extended, the parasite that must occupy another body. And similarly too, in human mental life, when generation goes on, it's the zero-sum game, it's the competitiveness, it's I only win if you lose, it's I must define myself by what I'm against. When the energy's been drawn from that, you know, if you read an argument and feel it's actually, it's mostly just saying what it's not rather than what it's lit, what it is, that's the generation state of mind. That's a generation mentality. And you can be sure that one way or another, it will either create war or will implode on itself. That is what the generation is about. So it's about survival of the fittest. It gets caught up in anger, in blame. Its will, its imagination is mostly about personal survival. That's its kind of soul quality, its inner energy. It's relatively mindless, certainly doesn't like critique. Blake called it the unfortunate contemplator, the mind that turns in on itself, if you like, and really, as well as being preoccupied, gets most concerned with others out of jealousy and envy. It wants what they've got, and if it can't have what they've got, it will seek to destroy them. It's that kind of quality of mind that generation has. When it disappears into its downside, Its upside is that it is generative. It wants to make more. But when it doesn't have access to the higher dimensions of imagination, it falls in on itself. And that was, in a way, another key dynamic for Blake. He realized that generation maybe in itself does have a good side, but it needs to be in the service of more than just its own state of mind, its own demons and angels, if it is to really enrich life and not fold in on life. What generation really needs is a third state of the imagination. We've had all row, reason rules. We've had generation, reproduction rules. In Beulah, third state, the third state of Beulah, relationship rules. Now, the word Beulah comes from the Hebrew Bible, the prophet Isaiah, who prophesies that the land will be Beulah. It will be espoused. It will be married to the Lord. And Blake, deeply influenced by lots of Bible imagery, adopted the word Beulah to describe his state of mind, his consciousness, his awareness, his quality of imagination that knows that relationship rules. One of the best places that he explores this is in his Songs of Experience, his famous set of poems. So, for example, in one of them he says, "Love seeketh not itself to please, but for another give its care." Love seeketh not itself to please, but for another give its care. So this is the state where love comes in. It's not just control of all row. It's not just generation with its desire to reproduce. Love comes in as well. I-it relationships get transformed into I-thou relationships, to use Martin Buber's famous expression. Love birds in nature, when you feel the love and vitality of certainly the animal world. I mean, I'm perfectly prepared to believe that people are getting into this in the plant world as well, because then generation is serving Beulah. The interest in trees, the interest in fungi. I think this is discovering the Beulah aspect of the natural world, of the environment, you might say, certainly in animal life. In human life, it's about love and human concern. It makes both for blissful rest, the sense of being held and loved. It makes too for romantic energy and passion. It makes for a sense of the soul, that there is an inner life. You know, maybe this is the first state that really believes that there's an inner life, because love enables you to feel that inner life and realize that the quality of an encounter matters much more than the quantity that might describe that encounter. So it starts to get a real felt sense of inner life. When you feel that, you know that you're in Beulah. Psychology, therefore, part of it. But it has a downside, because it is threefold vision, not yet fourfold vision. So, for example, in the Songs of Experience, William Blake will both say, "Love seeketh not itself to please, but for another gives its care." But in the poem that follows that, he says, "Love seeketh only self to please, to bind another in its delight. Love seeketh only self to please, to bind another in its delight." And this is the downside of Beulah, when it too, a bit like Oro, is how generation can become. Beulah too can become its own worst enemy when it loses sight of the fourfoldness that we need. That is experienced as panic and personal collapse, you know, when romantic love doesn't deliver, when love feels untrustworthy. It's when the love within a group implodes in on itself, and so the group becomes an enemy of another group. It's when empathy, which might reach out, also starts to define enemies, because empathy realizes it can't cure all, whilst it might be able to feel much. And so it's very easy for empathy, the friendship group, to fall into defining enemy groups too. It's why I think ultimately empathy, for all its good qualities, can't save us. And I get wary when I hear people talking about things in that way. It hasn't got yet the fourfold vision. It can fall in on itself. You know, this is where also where moralism, ethics becomes the main goal of religion, as I was mentioning early on. It's right because it's concern for others. It's wrong because that too easily disappears into a kind of guilt for how you can't help others, for how your own life might be destroying others. And that moralism, Blake called it the moral law. It's risky, a as well as having its good qualities, when left unchecked, it, I think, can lead to consumption too. The desire to love, you might say, the material world, that disappears into the consumption to have more and more of the material world, more and more objects that you feel like you love without realizing that they're extracting from the material world. For lovers of Philip Pullman, who are listening to this and his Dark Materials, you know, Philip Pullman's deeply influenced by William Blake. But ultimately, I think Philip Pullman presents a world which is threefold vision, because he doesn't actually trust the theistic vision that William Blake had. And so in his books, for example, Lyra, she loves, she's passionate, she has a relationship with her demon, with her soul. But ultimately, the plot is driven by the need to control, by the need to work out who the enemies are and to defeat the enemies. Beulah, for all its loveliness, for all its romanticism, can fall into this state. So that is the downside of Beulah. You know, when it's about imagination here, it's seen as the desire for a unity, for perfection. It's seen as the desire to join all together in a kind of perfect harmony. And whilst in one moment that they can see a lovely vision, it's a vision of love, it's a vision of compassion, ultimately you see that it's a vision that needs to destroy in order to force the unity together. It's a vision that finds imperfection intolerable at the end of the day. So it always risks becoming tyrannical or a bit mindless. That is because it doesn't have the fullness of imagination that Blake really wanted us to develop, which comes with his fourfold imagination that he called eternity. Now, in eternity, imagination itself rules. It's not reason ruling, it's not reproduction ruling, it's not even relationship ruling, it's imagination ruling. The people that get this for him are the artists that put all their effort, all their reason, all their generation, all their reproductive qualities, all their love of the material world even, and of image and of sight. They put it into the service of creation to make something new. So a bit like Van Gogh's sunflowers, you can never look at a sunflower again without realizing the soulfulness and the life that he released within the sunflower, but also created more of the sunflower as well in that artistic effort. I think the revolutionary scientist, to use Kuhn's expression, is in eternity too. Imagination is ruling. You know, you'll remember the story of Einstein discovering special relativity because he imagined what it might be like to sit on a light beam and to travel at the speed of light. It was that playful trust in the imagination that enabled him to see a whole aspect of reality and to create the science, the mathematics with others that could describe it, could really enter into it. So the revolutionary scientist understands this as well. The visionary like Blake clearly orientates their whole life, all their efforts, all their practice around to revealing it. You know, someone like Shakespeare, for example, who I think is a visionary as much as an artist, you sense it in Shakespeare because he himself has disappeared into his work. You know, Virginia Woolf made this comment that in Shakespeare, all desire to defeat the competitor, to vent his own frustrations, has been put into the service of the fullness of vision that his plays offer. So we feel we're meeting actual characters when we read his plays or see his plays, and not just Shakespeare's take on the world. Plato too, this is what I discovered in my PhD, was like that. You know, Plato, he appears in his dialogues three times and never speaks anything. It's always like Plato was at the door but then left. Plato was there but felt sick, so went home. He's saying that he's dying in his own works to reveal all the creative power that means his dialogues have inspired countless generations, even to now. In short, you know, to be in eternity is to be fully human, all that we might be. So the upside is you get this commingling of will, reason, of generation, reproduction, of love. But it produces more and more and more and more. It has these expansive qualities because, you know, to use the more common expression, is under the aspect of eternity. It sees things from outside itself as well as from within itself, and can join those two aspects together. It can die to itself. It's truly free. It forgives all, because it realizes that even the mistakes we make, say in Ulro, say in Generation, say in Beulah even, those mistakes are the errors that enable us to see where we've gone wrong and release into the more. So as Blake put it in his summary of Christianity, the one thing that matters in Christianity is the forgiveness of sins, not in the moral sense, because an Ulro like God will curse you if you don't get forgiven, but because we need to be in a constant state of forgiveness of our sins in order that we can know that we can step freely into more, that we can exercise our imagination. You know, you only learn the virtues of life by making mistakes. And so we're free to make mistakes in eternity. They become the springboards of the more. Death, such a key issue for the modern world now, which, you know, so often we get wrong because, like Ulro, like Generation, we feel we need to avoid it. Like Beulah, it's too painful to bear. In eternity, death comes to be seen as the way, because it releases you into more. You know, as T.S. Eliot put it, every moment is the time to die. Death is not just a thing that happens at the end of life. When you realize that it's happening in every moment, stepping into more life, that's how imagination, eternity, can conceive of death, reposition death. And similarly, whilst this is not remotely easy, it takes a whole lifetime to grow into, suffering as well can be seen as the process of change. You know, often it's only the sufferer that can really say this. And it's when you're a psychotherapist that at the end of a long process, the sufferer might be able to realize that, they might be able to befriend it. I say it very cautiously now, because this is not a moral imperative. This is a realization that might come at the end of a terrible process of suffering. But imagination at least allows for that possibility. It can imagine it in eternity. You know, it's a day-to-day practice. It's about learning to lean into your anxiety, not pull back and want to kind of try and control or overcome the anxiety. And it's often best practiced, as the great wisdom traditions have stressed, by noticing the small little perturbations of anxiety every day, leaning into them, realizing that they're actually, well, again, as the Buddhists say, the obstacles are the way. As Blake summarized it, he said, man was made for joy and woe. And when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. And safe because we realize we're always in more life than we know or can be consciously aware of. It's about a kind of surrender in awareness. It's an engaged openness that has realigned, to use the old Stoic Christian word, it's realigned with the Logos, with the divine imperative that runs through all things, sees itself tuning, harmonizing like the Aeolian harp with those things. It's different from Beulah in that it does seek unity, but it seeks unity in diversity. It fully understands the harmony. It has the imagination to see, if you might like to say, the kind of orchestra of life. And that's a real achievement. You know, unity is not remotely a straightforward thing. I mean, it's very easy to think, oh, I get it, because we're all the same. I mean, you know, we're all biological life, say. But if you're not careful, you're falling into Beulah's shadow there by insisting that all is just bare life. No, Blake would say that true creativity realizes the diversity and then how everything plays together. It's that diversity and unity. I think Dante got this. If you've ever read Dante's Divine Comedy, you'll know that when he gets into paradise, he's shocked at first because he still sees lots of individual souls. He thinks he's just going to see a kind of divine unity, a divine kind of mist, if you like, a divine undifferentiated light. And he sees loads of individual souls. And then he realizes that those souls are still individuals because they've become more and more and more themselves. And as they become more and more and more themselves, their will, their desire, and their knowledge, their sight has become more and more part of the whole. You know, their reason, Ulro, their generation, their reproductive capacities, their Beulah, their love has become part of the whole. And so he's living in eternity, in paradise, in imagination. It's a mistake to think that eternity doesn't love the minute particulars, as Blake put it. It's actually Ulro that dislikes the particular in its generalizations, in its abstractions, in its statistics. Eternity loves the particulars because it sees eternity in a grain of sand, infinity in a grain of sand, as Blake famously put it. It loves, too, the powers and principalities of this world. It can see, because it's stepped out of its own life, that there's other life elsewhere. It welcomes the imaginative sight of spiritual beings, other powers, the inner soul. It doesn't dismiss them as fantasies anymore. It knows it can be mistaken. Mistakes are fine. But it's prepared to discern and to learn and to gradually live more and more with that wider vision of things, that wider sense of its true life. And so it loves the mythopoetic and the emergent, which I know other people in this series are talking about as well. I think that's why they're such key capacities for engaging with life, because ultimately they move us to imagination. It even has a vision for the economy, because it sees that the economy is not about taking measurements to create a world of those very same measurements. It's about realizing that there can be an economy that serves the right ends. It's the meeting place of all, if you like. In Blake's poetry, like, for example, the great epic poem Jerusalem, he even talks about London, the city I live in, and says London is a place of mutual love and harmony when it's living in imagination, in eternity. It's Golgonooza, in his lovely neologism. In Golgonooza, my streets are ideas, my houses of thoughts, my inhabitants' affections, and they're constantly wellsprings, constantly generative. In eternity, in imagination. Similarly with the ecology, Blake has an idea which at first can be a bit tricky the ecology that you often read about, because he doesn't think that ecology is about just cooperating with nature. It's definitely about that, but that is just to exist in a state of Beulah for nature. For Blake, because he thinks that ultimately our relationship with nature and nature's relationship with us has got to be fired by the imagination. It's got to lift us both higher, if you like. When he sees infinity in a grain of sand, that's not just good for us and our vision. It elevates the grain of sand too. It means that in the grain of sand is literally all things as well. And that's the vision of nature, which in a way is a supernature. It's arising through to elevate nature more and more and more. That's the vision which he thinks we should develop when we're thinking about ecology. As he famously puts it, when the sun rises, he just doesn't see a guinea shaped like a circular disc of gold, lovely though that might be. He sees the heavenly host praising God, saying, holy, holy, holy. And the key point about Blake there is that his imagination doesn't read more into the sun, it sees more of the sun. So he can say, lead on, sun, in his vision of ecology, because the sun's light is the light that we all seek. And when we feel the sun on us materially and see the sun in paintings in our mind, we're being led into eternity. That's the vision of nature that he has. It's a consciousness that connects us to divine ends. As he says, he who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Beulah can bind ourselves to a joy but destroy it in that moment. But eternity means that we can kiss the joy as it flies, because we trust it will go on and on and on into eternity's sunrise. So the little question is, ask yourself, what state of mind are you in? Are you in Ulro, the imagination that wants to control? Sometimes we find ourselves in that state, especially under stress. Often we find society in that state when it feels the potential for its own collapse. But we must become aware of it to move perhaps into generation. This is the imagination that wants to produce more, but can make growth an end in itself. So watch out for that. Is this growth as an end in itself? That's to get stuck in generation, not to move into Beulah, which has the sense of love, I thou relationships. But again, be careful when you're in that lovely romantic state, because it might be that you want things to be perfect. You can't tolerate the imperfections. And the reason that they're so wonderful is because Blake put it, contraries release more energy. Carl Jung called it the transcendent function. And it's only when we can tolerate the contraries that we can be released into imagination proper, into eternity. When we see the world as consciously, because we know how our imagination is shaping the world, how our perception is shaped by that. And we're able to be creative with that too as well, because of that consciousness, to make the world renew, which is to rediscover reality in all its fullness afresh as well. Eternity is in love with the productions of time. William summarized it really rather wonderfully. When you're living in eternity, you love time, you love the present, because it makes for the productions that eternity loves as well. So look, just to summarize with a few kind of key, maybe more focused points, having, I hope, given you some sense of Blake's vision of the imagination, and not so much as a system, but as a practical way of existing in the world. Because I think it's that discernment that we need to tune in and align ourselves as we move into the future. But here's a couple of practicalities. I think we need to realize, you know, that the material world, this world, cannot bear all the expectations we have for it. In a way, this is capitalism's con trick, that it's made us realize, it's deluded us into thinking that our desires can be satisfied by endless material production, by living in generation. But we need to realize that this material world cannot satisfy all our desires once more. But also that we shouldn't stop wanting more. This is where I would disagree a little bit with certainly, the basic premise of the zero growth economists. I think that ultimately that might risk denying something of the human spirit, which is right to want more and more and more. But the trick is not to think that more and more and more can be delivered by any economy, can be delivered by the material world. That is just a part of it. We need to move into Beulah and into eternity. To do so, as well as discerning the states we're in, I think we might do well to pay more and more attention to what the psychologist of religion, Jeffrey Kripal, calls flips. And this is where we suddenly find ourselves in eternity, in imagination. And it's often quite a shocking experience. You know, we think we've had a paranormal experience. We think we have an NDE. And we think, we might have even been visited by extraterrestrials. Jeffrey Kripal makes a really important point that in these experiences, it's not actually the content that matters. It's the fact that you've been thrown into a wider world. And actually he thought, and I think this is right too, that many of the great spiritual teachers, and they precisely try to induce that experience in us. You know, it's why they tell parables like Jesus did that don't actually have a moral meaning. They are conundrums that are a bit like the Zen koans. Flips, these strange synchronicities that we have from time to time. Pay attention to them. Don't love them and the Beulah state too much. But use them to realize that they might become springboards, wellsprings that can lead you into eternity with a creative attitude towards them rather than kind of literal attitude towards them. Similarly, I think we're going to need to rediscover an awareness of the afterlife. You know, if this life can't deliver everything we want, if we flip from time to time into awareness that there's more lives around us than we ever knew, paranormal experiences, in telepathy experiences and so on. I think also we're going to need to realize that this life is in the service of a greater life, which is also our direction of travel into the afterlife. And this was always what people felt before. The difference now is we can do that even more consciously because of the struggles that we go through. I think this life is about developing the capacities to really experience the next life. That was certainly Dante's vision in the Divine Comedy, that Dante, as he travels through hell, through purgatory, has to see everything, even in its most awful states, in order that then he can experience everything when he enters paradise. And that ultimately happens in the afterlife. I think that is the meaning of our lives now. That'd be my best sense of it, at least right now, that this life, this moment is a preparation, not just for the next moment, but for the next life as well. It does that, though, by developing everything that reason offers, everything that reproduction offers, everything that relationship offers in order to release us into eternity. Now is a sort of struggle. There's no doubt about it. And we will find ourselves in all row from time to time, desperately wanting its security. We will find ourselves in generation sometime, wanting to grow. We all find ourselves in Beulah, longing for the love, longing for that which we trust and which trusts and love us. But ultimately, I think we must push into imagination. We must do it, I think, by listening. Above all else, you know, our psychotechnologies, our thought, our systems, they must be in the service of listening, which ultimately is an imaginative act. It's taking in and wondering what we hear, to hear more and more. And I think William Blake can be a great guide for us. He's worth struggling with his strange words, because in the struggle, he releases what he saw and can welcome us into the divine imagination. That is a quality which I think we need when we're thinking about the religions of the future.